We're back. Our subject for today is Caspian oil and how it affects American policy. Caspian oil has proven to be a blessing and a curse. Having rights to 60% of a sea of oil is certainly a blessing, but the oil must be transported to market, and therein lies the curse. To get a significant amount of Caspian oil to market requires a defensible pipeline. The U.S., Russia, and Iran are competing for control over piping Caspian oil and gas to world markets. Having Russia or Iran in a position to dictate terms on this last, largely untapped sea of oil could increase costs of oil in the West enormously. So American policy since the 90s has been to develop a diversified petroleum supply by breaking the Russian monopoly over transportation and ensuring the independence of the former Soviet republics by promoting rapid Caspian oil development. The Clinton administration supported multiple non-Russian routes over strong Russian objections, and it appears that multiple routes are still supported. The Russians are most unhappy at the prospect of losing control over what they regard as their strategic oil reserve. Despite their interests in both the Tengiz and Azerbaijan Sil fields, they have so far been less than helpful with projects to get Caspian oil and gas to market. Moscow has demanded that Russian oil companies be cut in on any pipeline consortiums and insisted that pipelines go through Russian-controlled territory. After the Russians cut off access to their pipelines for fear of competition with Siberian gas, the Turkmen government arranged to pipe gas to Iran, much to the consternation of Washington. By the end of 1998, Chevron and Mobil had developed an alternative that went around the Russians and accommodated their 200,000-barrel-per-day flow. They shipped their oil in small tanker loads across the Caspian Sea and then by rail across Azerbaijan, through Georgia, and on to the Black Sea. So goes the great game. Let's look at the alternatives for routing oil. There are, generally speaking, four possible routes, but all have one or more problems. These are the Black Sea route, a trans-Turkey route, a connection to existing Iranian pipelines, and perhaps most interesting, a route from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea. We'll look at this one in detail in a few moments. Despite Russian objections and political instability in the region, several new pipelines are under construction, one is complete, and all are expensive. In several plans, oil is piped to the eastern shore of the Black Sea, then shipped by tanker across to Romania or out to the Mediterranean. All the Black Sea routes have one of two problems: narrow shipping lanes or political instability. To get to the Mediterranean, oil must be shipped through the Bosphorus Strait and then into the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles. Neither of these narrow passages accommodates tankers large enough to be economical, and the route is torturous and environmentally sensitive besides. Landing oil on the western shore of the Black Sea and piping it across the Balkans does not seem particularly attractive, both because of the political instability in the Balkans and the expense. But despite these problems, a crude oil pipeline from the Tengiz field across Azerbaijan and Georgia to the Black Sea has been completed at a cost of nearly $600 million, twice the original estimate. The cheapest and most obvious route would be a short pipeline connecting to Iran's existing pipeline network and then to the Persian Gulf. One estimate is that it would cost the Turkmen government about $300,000 to build a spur connecting to the Iranian pipeline network. Iran has been in disfavor in Washington for some time now, so that route has not been pursued. There were hints of a softening in U.S. policy toward Iran during the Clinton administration, but that began to create major policy headaches and went nowhere. But there may still be a melting of the ice. In the April 2001 issue of Pipeline and Gas Industry, an oil patch trade journal, publisher George Ives Jr. comments, quote, "Attitudes have been known to change. In his previous life, didn't Veep Cheney suggest reducing U.S. sanctions against Iran?" As an alternative to Iranian routes, the U.S. is backing a 1,000-mile pipeline from Baku, Azerbaijan, across eastern Turkey to Ceyhan on the Turkish Mediterranean. This proposal also has its problems. First, at $4 billion, it's by far the most expensive option and may not be economically viable. Second, the Russians have strongly objected to it because Caspian oil producers would no longer depend on Russian pipelines. Expense and Russian objections aside, there's the specter of terrorism. The route travels through unstable Kurdish territory in eastern Turkey and terminates close to Syria, known supporters of terrorists. Terrorist vulnerability could be mitigated if Iran was to participate in the project, and the Iranians have expressed interest. But in keeping with U.S. isolation policy, the Clinton administration blocked Iranian participation. What the Bush administration may do with respect to Iran remains to be seen. But this fall, Putin visited President Bush at his ranch for barbecue and horseshoes. And a subsequent report in Pipeline and Gas Industry indicates that the project is a go. This brings us to the Afghan route. This is most interesting, both because of the fallout from September 11 and because it's an example of the political intrigue that oil companies and their governments engage in. Governments are no strangers to the oil business. The line between national interests and those of oil companies has always been indistinct. Great Britain set up and owned British Petroleum to ensure a reasonably priced adequate fuel supply for its navy. The Caspian Area Republics own oil companies that are partners with foreign firms that develop their resources. And it should be no surprise that because of our dependence on oil, the national interests of the U.S. are inseparable from those of Western oil companies. The Afghan route, which crosses Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, was originally planned by Brightus, an Argentinian firm. They have spent heavily on gas exploration in Turkmenistan and acquired several concessions. In the mid-90s, Brightus invited the American firm Unocal to become part of a consortium because they needed Unocal's political experience in Pakistan. In his book Taliban, Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist, explains how Brightus was cut out of its deals in favor of Unocal. But in the end, both companies fell prey to events they could no longer control. Taliban, by the way, is a very worthwhile read. Brightus had already developed oil fields in Turkmenistan when they discovered rich gas fields in 1995. Turkmen President Niyazov not only stopped development of the gas field, but stopped Brightus oil exports from existing fields too, and eventually froze its assets. The reason was that Niyazov, now quoting from Rashid, quote, saw that Unocal could become the means to engage a major U.S. company and the Clinton administration in Turkmenistan's development, telling the Americans that they needed to support him if they were to prevent him from becoming dependent on Iran. Niyazov's threats bore fruit. In October 1995 at the UN in New York, Niyazov signed a deal with Unocal and its Saudi partner Delta Oil to build a gas pipeline through Afghanistan. Thus was formed CentGas, a consortium of Unocal, Delta, state-owned Turkmenistan, and a 10% stake reserved for the ever-present Russian Gazprom. Unocal also set up another consortium, the Central Asian Pipeline Project, or CAOPP, to pipe oil 1,000 miles from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea. Unocal offered to cut the Russians in on the deal to avoid the problems Chevron and Mobil were having with Russian resistance to pipelines headed west from Kazakhstan. The CAOPP line was to connect with existing Soviet-era lines carrying oil from Russia's Siberian oil fields. This would provide an outlet to the Arabian Sea for both Russian oil and gas, something that the broke Russians could never have done by themselves. The Russians, however, were having none of it. As Rashid reports, quote, the Russian giant refused to sign as Moscow criticized U.S. sponsorship of the Taliban and the undermining of Russia in Central Asia. After arming the Mujahideen with billions worth of armaments, the U.S. had walked away from Afghanistan when the Soviets gave up in 1989. This left the Saudis, Iranians, Pakistanis, and Uzbeks to deal with the inevitable civil war enabled by the unlimited weaponry available to the Afghan warlords. Each propped up their ethnic surrogates, prolonging the war. Once the U.S.-backed Taliban gained control of Kabul, the U.S. was quick to recognize and support them, believing that they could deliver a unified government suitable for foreign investment. This angered the Russians still further. It is Rashid's opinion that it has been in the interests of Iran and Russia to keep the region unstable so that American-sponsored pipelines could not succeed. Despite their competing interests, this is entirely plausible given Iran's proximity and the Islamic axiom that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Despite the agreement signed at the UN, Bridas was not about to give up, according to Rashid. In 1996, he writes, they brought suit against Unocal and Delta in a county court near Houston. Unocal ultimately prevailed in court on a jurisdictional ground. But in the meantime, the Clinton administration interceded on behalf of Unocal, demanding that Prime Minister Bhutto switch support from Bridas to Unocal. It's unclear if this effort was successful. No Western banks were willing to provide financing for a project in a country torn by civil war. Rashid also reports that Bridas had a major advantage over Unocal in that they did not need financing from the IMF, the World Bank, or Western commercial banks, and thus could cut deals with individual warlords. It is also plausible that Bridas may have had backing from the Russians. In 1998, the situation for Unocal began to deteriorate. Fighting broke out once again in the spring. In an attempt to ferret out Osama bin Laden after the bombings of U.S. embassies, the U.S. began bombing the terrorist camps it had helped set up. The Taliban fell from favor for harboring bin Laden, and the news of the Taliban's treatment of women hit the American press. The Asian currency collapse depressed world oil prices to levels not seen since the pre-1973 embargo days. These factors forced Unocal to abandon its stake in CentGas and pull its staff out of the country. But for the collapse of world oil prices, this might have left the field open once again for Bridas. Since 1998, Bridas has sold 60% of its Latin American holdings to Amoco, an American firm, and the Bush administration has refused to support a bailout of the Argentine currency. Amoco has merged with ARCO and British Petroleum to form yet a new oil giant. Bridas prospects are unknown. The Bush administration's public obsession with getting bin Laden at the expense of a larger strategy may mask an expectation that a pipeline project, including Unocal or another American firm, can resume now that the Taliban are out and the Northern Alliance is in. To expect quick resolution to the problem by ousting a religious faction and supporting a coalition of warlords requires a major suspension of disbelief. As President Bush has said, it will be a long struggle. The patterns of history in this region are not comforting to people who depend on its oil and gas, and neither are the proposals for getting oil to Western markets. The events of the Great Game have helped to produce largely disenfranchised, impoverished Islamic kleptocracies, whose citizens have little hope for the future and less for the present. Their rulers cut deals to enrich themselves, leaving the Arab street as dusty and impoverished and chaotic as ever. Such a moral vacuum is not hard to fill. Islamic fundamentalism has stepped in to fill that vacuum across much of the Islamic world. While not the only cause, Afghan civil war has greatly exacerbated the problem of terrorism and helped to spread it. Combine this religious undercurrent with the Arab street's profound suspicion of the U.S. and their own governments, and its belief that American oil companies do the bidding of the CIA, and you have a Gordian knot that probably cannot be untied. Once again, history repeats itself. As with the Bolshevik Revolution that caught Exxon, and the upheaval in Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Afghan government's change in mid-negotiation requires new negotiations with a new government. That is, provided one can find a government to negotiate with. Background material for this program came from oil industry trade journals, including Pipeline and Gas Industry, Anthony Sampson's book, The Seven Sisters, A History of the Oil Industry Through 1975, a three-part series published in October 1998 in the Washington Post by staff writers Dan Morgan and David Ottaway, and much background material on Central Asian politics came from Ahmed Rashid's book, Taliban. This has been Tom Allen with Energy Chronicle No. 1.